The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The history of television is a history of failure.
For every television series that lasted years and years, there were dozens that lasted only one season or less.
But did they deserve to die? Or were they canceled too soon?
Everybody, and welcome back to Canceled Too Soon, the podcast where we review TV shows that lasted only one season or less. My name is William Bibiani. I'm a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. And this is Suddenly Last Season, where we're talking about shows that were just canceled.
Very recently failed.
Yeah, our last episode was devoted to Jupiter's Legacy, the expensive Netflix bomb that was canceled before I think they even aired every episode.
I think they dumped it all.
They usually dump it all in one day.
So they dumped it all in one day,
and then
before anyone had finished watching
very
it.
Very shortly after that they were going to cancel it, so that was just off the table. And that was based on a comic book. Now we're going to... And I'm not exactly sure what sort of cultural clout this has, and this is how I feel about every TV show that's being adapted from a film. How popular the source material really was, like how much cultural clout it was still carrying in 2021.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the crime series Lincoln Rhyme Hunt for the Bone Collector.
The Great Lincoln Rhyme.
You're going to want to see this.
Well, kiss my ass.
You can thank Officer Sachs here for saving that evidence.
I read your file. Cop going for her PhD in criminal psychology. You're a blank slate with great instincts.
Is that a compliment?
I'd like you to be my point person in the department. I'm ready for another shot at the bastard who put me in this bed.
You want being a crime scene without ever leaving your bed? Two cameras, 360 degree view, voice comm through an earpiece.
Billy, can you hear me? I'm right here with you. I feel the
okay, so the Bone Collector was originally a novel by Jeffrey Deaver, and it's actually a successful novel. It's had a whole bunch of follow-ups with titles like The Coffin Dancer and The Stone Monkey. it led to a pretty dang successful movie in the late 90s starring Denzel Washington, Angelina Jolie, and Queen Latifah.
The premise was the main character, Lincoln Rhyme, the main detective, was paralyzed by the Bone Collector.
Yeah, who is
a serial killer.
Yeah, he's tetraplegic. Mm. He's confined to a bed. He can only move his head pretty much, and as a result, it's hard for him to do the usual action movie shtick. And so he teams up with a beat cop played by Angelina Jolie, who is actually very bright and has very good instincts. So she can be his eyes and ears out in the field, and he can use his brilliant Sherlock Holmesian mind in order to finally solve the case of this ruthless serial killer. The Bone Collector was, the movie, one of a series of serial killer thrillers in the 1990s that were mostly kicked off by The Silence of the Lambs.
The Silence of the Lambs, and only... You know, Seven was part of this wave, and Seven really bolstered it because that was a big hit as well.
Kiss the Girls was a gigantic hit.
Kiss the Girls, Along Came a Spider, Double Jeopardy is in that camp.
Double Jeopardy isn't about a serial killer, but it's a similar thriller vibe. Yeah, Ashley Judd got her own subgenre there for a while.
The Fugitive was not, but I would argue that its sequel, U.S. Marshals, kind of was.
Yeah.
It had a little bit more of like that pulpy airport novel tone.
Yeah, airport novel is definitely the vibe here. These are very pulpy films. However, what I think is most interesting is that most of the really successful ones were police procedurals, like 50% police procedural and 50% horror movie.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
were very lurid. They were very dark. They were very, they were trying to be very edgy.
The murders were incredibly violent, and they invariably involved doing something creative with a corpse.
Yeah. There's always a serial killer who's trying to be more outlandish than the most recent one, because otherwise it can't really build a whole movie around.
I'm the deer killer, and I sew my victims to deer bodies. And
yeah.
It just gets increasingly ridiculous. It really kind of hit its peak with the TV series Hannibal.
Mm-hmm. Which came along quite a bit later.
They took these notions that were being introduced to us in the 90s and just sort of writ them larger.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden...
It's a whole opera.
Yeah, the cop is now pretty much legitimately psychic. Like, he has superpowers at this point. Like every third person you run into is a serial killer, and they all recognize each other because they have serial killer spider sense.
Yeah, they look across the room and they know that you've killed a lot of people, and somehow you've like turned their intestines into violin wire so you could play the best violin ever.
Yeah,
and then you have to do like a kung fu fight with them. Like, and it's Hannibal the series. It's completely absurd. I was totally on board with that series, and I still am.
Uh-huh.
I love that series. We do have to acknowledge that it is fundamentally absurd. It is so over the top, much like its characters, that it's kind of the perfect encapsulation of this whole genre. Mm. Because the whole serial killer pulp crime thriller genre that was, again, wasn't really invented in the 90s, but was very much codified in the 90s.
Super popularized.
These are not down-to-earth, you know, realistic cop dramas. These are... wild, lurid, and frankly often absurd horror stories with a cop in them, basically. And some of them are quite good. And The Bone Collector, directed by Philip Noyce, is actually quite good.
Yeah. Philip Noyce has he made a lot of hits. He made those Jack Ryan movies.
He made Patriot Games, A Clear and Present Danger, two of the good ones. He did Dead Calm, which is fucking great. He did Blind Fury, which is very silly and wonderful.
An American Zatoichi adaptation.
Yep. He did Salt with Angelina Jolie, which does kick ass.
That's an excellent movie. Love Salt.
Just an excellent filmmaker. Just doesn't necessarily have a particularly unique signature style, but he can just kind of do anything. I'm actually surprised he never made a James Bond movie. It would have been kind of perfect for it.
He was right in that that camp. And now we have, for some reason, we're digging up these novels. Now, the novels have continued to be published.
Yep, still going.
Yeah, that's the Lincoln Rhyme series is still going. And this premise of a cop who is confined to a bed and can only look at TV screens and communicate through microphones and cameras while they help, like, while they're sort of the mastermind helping a team out in the field. Not a bad premise.
It's novel.
Yeah.
The star of the Denzel Washington played Lincoln Rhyme in the movie, and here we've got Russell Hornsby, very good actor, taking over the role. It's a little disappointing that this was kind of a golden opportunity for representation for a disabled actor.
Yeah.
We didn't go there. I think Russell Hornsby is very good in this.
Mm-hmm.
We've got, as in the Angelina Jolie role, we've got an actor named Ariel Keble, he's done a lot of TV. They were on Gilmore Girls, The Vampire Diaries, that reboot of 90210. They were on Ballers, Dwayne Johnson series. And then there's also a bunch of like new characters
it's an ongoing series, so rather than it be just the two of them, like a two-hander investigation show, you now need the team. So in addition to this, we have the sort of nerdy research guy. We have sort of like the tech nerd girl, and we have like
Nerd guy, and then the other girl, she's the sort of the forensic scientist. Right. She gets really like excited by dead bodies and stuff.
And then we have the grizzled old veteran who's also on the team.
Played by Michael Imperioli, who frankly seems a little too good for the size of his role in the show. Like, Michael Imperioli is a very respectable actor. Michael Imperioli has been acting for many, many years now. I've been a fan of him since he played Spider in Goodfellas. But he just plays older cop number one. Yeah. here. Sorry, he doesn't really have a lot to work with, and that's kind of a shame.
I like older Coppa. Like, he's a good enough actor that he's bringing a lot of personality to very little. And same with Brooke Lyons, who plays she was Kate. She's the forensic person. She clearly modeled after the Polly Perrette character from I think it's
NCIS.
Yeah. Who was like sort of this like feisty teenage goth who was also their computer expert.
You might know her from The Affair. Is one of her, her biggest roles today. She was on Two Broke Girls for a while.
And their headquarters is Lincoln Rhyme's home. They operate out of his place because it's equipped with all the things he needs to live.
Which he shares with his caregiver, Claire, played by Rosalind Ruff. Rosalind Ruff, you might know from stuff like Rachel Getting Married.
That was a good movie. Like that movie.
She's on The Godfather of Harlem. She was in Madam Secretary for a while. And I actually like the wrinkle they gave to Claire, because I don't recall this being in the... I haven't read the books. I only seen the movie. I don't recall this being in the movie. But she is actually agoraphobic.
Yeah,
she has trouble leaving the house.
She kind of has to leave.
She's encouraging Lincoln Rhyme to try to, stop feeling sorry for himself and actually try to, sort of re-engage with the world and go outside more, while she herself will not. And that's actually an interesting irony. And I actually really like their relationship together. I think Russell Hornsby and Rosalind Ruff play off each other really, really well. But ostensibly, the other main lead is Ariel Kebble. And Amelia Sachs is introduced... I think in kind of an interesting way. In the original movie and in the pilot, it happens differently, but the way that these two characters meet is Amelia Sachs is on her usual daily rounds, and then they stumble across a serial killer crime scene. Mm-hmm. However, because of something that's about to happen, the crime scene is about to get ruined. In the movie, I believe it's about to start raining or something similar. And in the show, a subway is about to run over the corpse. So in the movie, she basically just tries to collect as much evidence as she can, knowing next to nothing but just using common sense about how to take pictures of things and make sure there are things in the picture to create... context, make sure a footprint's next to a $1 bill so you know exactly how big the footprint is, that kind of thing. Smart things. And in the show, she has to play chicken with a subway, with a train car.
It can make it a lot more exciting.
It's a bit ridiculous, but it's fine. In the show, she has a younger sister who disappears quickly after being used as kidnapping fodder. And then they also mention that she has a variety of anxiety issues, which she lied about on her FBI application, which is why she couldn't become a serial killer profile, which was her dream. This doesn't come up very often, though.
It stems from the fact of trauma she experienced as a child when a criminal murder... It's like the Batman story. A criminal murdered her parents in front of her.
Yeah. But, the idea... And I was actually really excited because I was like, oh, so here's a cop show where one of the cops has a variety of anxiety issues. And that's something we usually don't see. Often cops in these movies are very resilient. Or they can get drunk and then get over their shit or whatever like that. And the idea of having one who was actively dealing with mental health issues is really exciting to me. It doesn't come up very often. In fact, most of the episodes you'd never know.
No, and in fact, we're laying down all this backstory. A lot of this is completely insignificant to the structure of the show. This isn't a hard-hitting character piece. There aren't a lot of moments where the characters sit and talk. There's just enough moments where the characters sit and talk. This is taking the Bone Collector idea, which is kind of a grisly idea and was played for shocks when it came out. Bone Collector collects bones, sees human beings as just piles of things and wants to rip them apart and collect bones. There's a scene in the movie where, and it's probably in the book too, where Angelina Jolie is trekking through a sewer. She's got a camera so Lincoln Rhyme can watch along, and she's got an earpiece. And they find I think it's a burnt corpse. It's mutilated in some way.
Yeah.
And Lincoln Rhyme notices that the handcuffs are really, unique. They're interesting in some way. They're a clue.
Yeah.
But in order to get to the handcuffs, she would have to saw the hands off of the corpse. And she's way too squeamish to take care of something like that. So it's like, I need you to saw the hands off. And she's, it's all played for horror. And she ends up having to leave without doing it. It's like, don't ask me to saw up corpses. That's not my thing. This TV series on NBC, it's an NBC show, doesn't have, has none of that Grand Guignol quality at all.
No, not really.
It's in there, but we're so used to it now. That stuff was grisly in the 90s that this is just regular Law and Order fodder.
Well, it's not, here's the deal. I think this is what it boils down to, is all of that stuff's in there and it could have been played up.
Yeah.
Maybe not to the Hannibal level of we're playing everything on a scale of 1 to 10, this is a 15. But it could have been played up on a level of 1 to Bone Collector or 1 to Kiss the Girls or whatever. Basically, all you had to do was treat the idea of these murders. And the whole season arc is catching the Bone Collector, and most of the episodes are dedicated to that. But a little more than half the episodes also have a crime of the week. Basically, anytime there was a murderer or something grisly, play it for scares instead of just playing it as a typical police procedural.
This is a crime scene, yeah.
Yeah, instead they treat it as a typical police procedural, the kind of thing you'd see on Law and Order or pretty much anything, any of, its, any of the major ripoffs.
All of those, yeah.
And as a result, this the selling point, which is, I mean, A, there's the idea of Lincoln Rhyme. He's a very distinctive protagonist. But the other selling point is we're catching the grisliest killer.
Yeah.
Is completely undermined.
Well, it's undermined because if you're dealing with the world's grisliest killer, how do you continue that into a series? Now, I know there's a, the approach to a lot of cable and streaming shows is to just tell a really long movie. Have all of the episodes just interconnect, and it just there's a break every hour, essentially.
Every season of Dexter is a different movie.
Exactly. Yeah. This is an NBC series, so it's a lot more episodic, and you can't have, A, the gore on network TV, and B, you can't have those same kinds of arcs on network TV. So they're going
They struggle with it.
You can, but clearly they're going for the hit police procedural mold, which has proven very successful in the past. How many hours of Law and Order are there? I don't think I've lived that many hours.
SVU alone is like old enough to drink.
SVU, I think, is on its, like, 26th or 27th season
at this
astounding. Point. The original Law & Order ended after 20. I think Criminal Intent ended, but I don't know about that.
There's a million of them is the point.
Yeah, I've lost the beat on all of the newest of the Law & Orders.
Yeah, but then you add in your NCIS's, your CSIs.
This sort of hybrid thing where we're chasing the Bone Collector and we're given clues a little bit in every episode. Mm. And we meet the Bone Collector early on. We know who it is.
That's a new wrinkle, because in the movie it was a twist. I'm not going to write it for you, but in the movie it was a twist. In this one, we see the actual gag, and it's actually a pretty clever way to start the series because
let me finish my thought.
They
have the hybrid model where we know a little bit about the serial killer, but then we also have a case of the week.
Exactly.
That's all I wanted to say. No, anyway,
I think the pilot episode is very well structured. I think it's one of those things where the cast hadn't quite found their roles yet. A lot of people are kind of just giving perfunctory plot things to do. But the general gist of it is our protagonist stumbles across a body, has to do something remarkable in order to preserve the crime scene. Lincoln Rhyme, who has retired from crime fighting after a prologue in which he was trying to save someone from the Bone Collector, fell from a great height, and now he's tetraplegic. He's pulled out of retirement in order to investigate perhaps the return of the Bone Collector. And the twist at the end of the episode is that this was a copycat. So that's clever, actually. It gives you this sense of closure in the pilot. But by the end of the pilot, we see the actual Bone Collector looking at TV, seeing that Lincoln Rhyme is up again, my arch nemesis, and deciding to go back into business. And that's neat. That's a pretty clever way to handle it. The Bone Collector, is played by an actor named Brian F. O'Byrne, who's been around for a long, long time. He played a priest in Million Dollar Baby. He was in the Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. He was in that William Friedkin movie, Bug. You've probably seen him in something. He's a very recognizable character actor. Mm-hmm. And the gimmick with his character is that he's starting to, you know, get back up to speed, get back into this mojo, start killing again. He's also happily married, and his wife has no idea what he does. And he's got to keep it from her. And he's got to, like, sort of engineer excuses for, like, hey, let's go back to New York. Remember when we lived in New York and how much nicer everything was? And so he's got to basically trick her into doing things that will facilitate his serial killings. Mm. Which is clever, actually. Huh. I think that's it gives us a little bit more suspense. When's she going to find out? Is she going to find out? Mm. That's not bad. Mm-hmm. It works.
And that story does come to a conclusion.
Yes, it does. In a really sad one.
Pretty shocking way.
Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. What happens is, this isn't really super relevant to the rest of the plot. She finds in their apartment a whole bunch of photographs.
Polaroids
that the bone collector has taken of his various crimes and victims. And she's horrified. Mm. And she tells him, like, I found all these photographs. And he's like, oh... Hmm. And she's like, yeah, we should tell the cops we found these in our apartment. One of the previous tenants was, hey, didn't we used to know her? Hmm. And he's like, okay, I need to suffocate you now. And he, like, ties her up, and he's like, there's a whole episode of just him debating what to do about this. Hmm. And she's trying to talk him down. It's like, listen, you're starting to screw up.
Yeah.
I didn't know for years. Now you're letting your guard down. You're making mistakes. It's only a matter of time before you're caught. You love me. I believe that. Why don't you just let me go? Mm. I'll give you a head start, and I'll tell them you escaped. Mm. And then go on the lam, and good luck to you. And that's the best I can do. And he lets her go, and then snaps her neck. And it's really fucking sad.
Yeah. And it takes her a few seconds to die. It's not like one of those movie deaths where you snap the death and they just fall dead.
Yeah.
It's like, no, she's like, can look at him one last time while she's dying.
And they say that, like, if you were decapitated, like, with a guillotine...
Your head stays alive for a few seconds, yeah.
Can you imagine what that would be? I can't even imagine how horrifying that would be.
Well, you wouldn't feel any pain. It would be too much shock.
I hope not. Yeah. But, like, regardless, like, can you imagine... Just the it's a few seconds of awareness about what has happened to you.
Yeah.
Is this... incredible kind of horror.
Give you a chance to look down your own throat. One final penetrating glance at your executioner.
Great, that's exactly the thought I want to take with me as I venture off either into the afterlife or as my brain just slowly starts to fade away. Like, that's the last thing I want to think about. Not my loved ones, not my favorite memories, just the stump.
Well, here's an axe. Let's find out.
Oh, God.
But yeah, that's sort of the general arc of the Bone Collector, that character. And that's the thing that lasts throughout the entire season of 10 episodes that aired on NBC. Every episode besides has a crime or a killer of the week.
Yeah, the last, like, two or three is, like, this big, long hunt for the Bone Collector.
The last two, is, like, a big two-parter where they're hunting for the Bone Collector.
Yeah, so we've got... let's take a quick look at some of these. So the
serial killers... I whined about how absurd the world of Hannibal was, but at least that was creative shit. It's like, I'm going to kill somebody and lay out their bodies with spores in them so they're going to rot and turn into mushrooms and leave, like, a body-shaped mushroom.
That one was creepy, right?
Yeah.
There's, like, all these, so, like, they're creative and they think about, like, the psychology of these people, and it's just really morbid and weird. Here, it's really perfunctory. The second episode... pissed me off real bad, just because it's not well written. Mm. It's called God Complex, and basically they're finding a serial killer who kills people based off of Greek mythology, but a very bad understanding of Greek mythology.
The kind of Greek mythology, like, as you learned it in the second grade.
Yeah.
Like not detailed, not, you know, just sort of big stories. And it's all the really obvious ones everybody knows about. So it's the Icarus story.
Yeah.
And the Orpheus story. It's, you know... No deep cuts. It doesn't require a Lincoln Rhyme type intellect to understand what's going on.
And what pisses me off is that you run into the situation where you have created this character, Lincoln Rhyme in particular. He's supposed to be a super duper genius.
Yeah.
And his crew, like, Amelia may not have, like, those, like, rich library smarts, but she's very intelligent and observant. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the computer tech guy who's very intelligent and observant. You've got the forensic lady who's very intelligent and observant. You've got the hard-boiled cop who's seen it all. Mm-hmm. These are people who are at the top of their game. So when they find out that one of the serial killer's likely patterns is going to be the Orpheus story... Mm-hmm. And they find out that this one person who witnessed the murder as a child and is now grown up and is a musician, they visit that guy and they try to make sure that it's like, okay, it's not him. He hasn't gone crazy or anything. Okay. But yeah, the killer doesn't seem to be going after Orpheus. So we'll leave him with his girlfriend. And then halfway through the episode, Lincoln Rhimes is like, wait a minute. The story of Orpheus ends really badly for Orpheus's girlfriend, not so much Orpheus himself. And I'm like, yes. Now, I appreciate that not every single human being in the world knows Greek mythology, but you should, because you're supposed to be a super duper genius. And that is some very superficial. That's not like the hidden meaning of the story. That's just the plot of the Orpheus and Eurydice. It's Eurydice, right?
Eurydice.
Eurydice, okay.
Yeah, I had an Orpheus joke, but looking back, it wasn't a good idea. Hey! There were a lot of these classical Greek, I have a classical Greek joke. I have a Cassandra joke, you wouldn't believe, that kind of thing. That was my bag on Twitter for a second. There's a few montages throughout this series where we get to see Lincoln Rhyme like putting stuff together, and they have this like big visual montage of like what he's thinking about floating around.
He's remembering all of the architecture of New York simultaneously.
Set in New York, so it's like, I remember this one building, and it was built with this kind of material, and that would actually affect like what sort of signs we'd see in the basement, and that's how we know where this killer is. That's an interesting fact that would help you catch a killer that only this guy or like a small group of people might have the knowledge of. That only happens like maybe a quarter of the time he's brainstorming, where he like reveals something that's actually interesting. The other is, wait a minute, the Orpheus story was actually about something about hell, if I remember.
Like, I appreciate that, like, you're not everyone in the audience is gonna want like the brainiest detective story ever. But
I
am too. I would love that. But again, you're writing a super genius character. You want them to not be. Well, I don't want to say stupid, but you want them to overlook gigantic things like that. Mm. It's like, I've talked about this a lot. There's that movie Limitless with Bradley Cooper. And the whole plot of the movie is that he finds this drug that allows him to unlock the complete potential of his brain and become the smartest person in the world as long as he's on the drug. Mm. You can't have a character whose superpower, more or less, is that they're super intelligent, do stupid things.
Yeah.
So you can't have him, say, keep all of his pills in his coat and then hand his coat to somebody without thinking about it, and then pick it up a scene later, and then in the couple of scenes later realize that his pills are gone. He wouldn't have gotten rid of handed his pills to anybody. If he did, he would have checked immediately.
Or if that was a plot point, like he started to forget again, like he was building up a resistance.
But that
to the
wasn't
drug,
it. There's another one where like he gets this like ultra secure high tech high rise apartment. Cool. It isn't until like the Russians that he borrowed money from and literally forgot to pay back, so that's not very smart.
Well, not only did he forget, but earlier in the movie he said, if you're gonna borrow from Russians, pay them back immediately. Like,
and
he didn't follow his own advice. Yeah.
And then they're literally like chainsawing through the door or some shit to try to kill him, and it's only then that he realizes that this apartment that he bought doesn't have cell phone reception. That's the first thing you check when you look at an apartment.
Hook it up to the Wi-Fi.
Hook it up to the Wi-Fi. Just make sure that, like, you know, when you turn on your phone, it doesn't have zero bars.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to, like, get an apartment in a Skinner box. Like, it's not really going to help anything. Faraday cage. Not Skinner box.
Faraday cage.
Sorry, I mix those two up all the time.
Skinner, yeah. Faraday cage is the cage that prevents signals.
Yeah. A Skinner box is one that's like a gambling thing. It teaches you, like, you know, to press a button and it.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you keep pressing that button.
It's the rat reward machine. Yeah. And that's my biggest issue with Lincoln Rhyme is it's about very intelligent cops, and they're constantly saying intelligent-sounding cop things. But this is specious intelligence. It sounds like it's smart, when really it isn't. I feel like this show was designed from the bottom up to be watched while you're preparing dinner. This is a police procedural.
It's most
meant
networked
to be,
cop shows.
Yeah, and I think this is designed in that mold to the point where they are holding themselves back from being too intelligent or creative. They want it to be kind of middle of the road, it is really easily consumed.
Oh, yeah.
This goes down super easy.
Yeah.
There is not a tough scene throughout
no
this entire
challenging.
Series.
It's like, occasionally there's a good moment, but, like, it's nothing like.
I actually tested it once.
I
left the show going, and I went up to get a glass of water and left it running. And I came back, and I missed nothing. Like, I could still follow the show scene for scene.
Yeah, that's how a lot of network television works.
And yeah, so this was designed to be that, to the point where I can tell people are holding themselves back. The actors are holding themselves back. They're not giving themselves bigger moments when the dramatic scenes come. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they're biting into the really chintzy, not very smart dialogue with just enough energy so they seem committed, but not so much that they seem like they're trying to create something big.
Yeah, and which is a problem when you're telling a story, which is the season-long arc about catching a serial killer who's the arch nemesis of your protagonist. That's big. That's a big story, and you're playing it so small.
Here's the thing. It isn't anymore.
Well, you know what I mean. That's their vibe, right?
It's supposed to be, but yeah. Serial killer is such a worn genre at this point that it's comfort watching. Patton Oswalt has a bit about this. His late wife was a big fan of true crime shows.
Yeah, yeah.
She authored a book and also a TV series, I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
Yeah.
And he said that she wouldn't want to go see like Sergio Leone movies, like Westerns, because they're too violent.
Yeah.
And in those movies, maybe three people get shot in a 3-hour span. Mm-hmm. And when they do, there's no blood. They just sort of clutch their chests and slump over very slowly.
Or it's like poster paint. It's like super fake.
Yeah. And she said, no, I can't do that. That's too violent. But then she'll go home and watch a serial killer drama about, oh, yes. And then Patton Oswalt's line is, yes, he made a necklace out of vaginas. And it's like, that's... And she's just eating ice cream, having a wonderful time watching that kind of show.
Yeah. Apologies, by the way, for that horrible thing Wendy just said, in case anyone's eating ice cream at home.
I am quoting, that's the tone of these shows.
I know,
it's like the most horrendous things, delivered with very sort of frank pat delivery.
I know, here's the thing.
But they're being sold and consumed as comfort food.
This isn't, but here's the thing, in a procedural, the comfort is in the procedure. The comfort is in these horrible things happen, but there's a system. And according to these shows anyway, maybe not so much in real life, but the system works. And that's where the comfort comes from. Mm. These things will be handled. In something like The Bone Collector, we're dealing with a case of a serial killer who's been at large for many, many years. Things are not being handled. Mm. There's a serious problem. And it turns out that the person who was responsible for it is actually, like, a forensic analyst who went to school with Lincoln Rhyme. Mm. And, like, he literally, like, his whole, like, obsession with Lincoln Rhyme comes from Lincoln Rhyme just being a glory hog. And he's like, I'm actually just as smart as this guy, but because he always just, like, jumps into the room announcing he solved the crime, it doesn't matter that I have also solved the crime, he just spoke louder than me.
Yeah.
And so, as a result, he gets all the attention, like... This should be frightening. Mm. This should be, like, upsetting as a story arc. That someone this diabolical is at large. But because it's played like a procedural, that never sells. And it just feels like it's underplayed. There is there's a couple episodes. There's an episode called Russian Roulette, which is actually kind of clever.
Episode three,
Russian Roulette, where there's a possible break in a missing persons case from many, many years ago that was left completely unsolved. How that break occurs is really arbitrary and doesn't make sense. Like, oh, we found this thing that's a charm from this one person's charm bracelet from like 5 years ago. And I'm like, I think they mass produce those things. That could be anybody's. It's kind of thin, but
it was a letter L. It wasn't so.
It's a letter L. Yeah. Like, come on. It's like,
it's a one of a kind thing.
It's so like the whole basis of your story is pretty thin, but the clever thing is that they're in this really tight knit, Russian immigrant neighborhood, and nobody is talking.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there's a reason why nobody is talking, and that's because
they
solved the problem themselves, and they're just like, listen, everyone in the neighborhood was like, that guy is an asshole. We killed that guy. And so we're just all shutting the fuck up, and if you cops would just let it go, we would be fine right now. That was kind of an interesting idea for a story. I actually really quite like the setup of the episode What Lies Beneath. Mm. This actually takes place at a college for forensic science, and they actually have a field.
Oh, this is, yeah. The
this is neat.
Decomposition field. And I tried looking this up, and I don't think it's real.
That's a shame, but it's a cool idea. And the idea is, when you're studying dead bodies, you need to study them in various states of decomposition from various places, and you can't just wait for a corpse to show up at the bottom of a ravine. So the idea is that they have a field, a natural preserve. Yeah, and they have people, when they die, they donate their bodies to science, and these bodies are left to decompose in various states so that people can study the way bodies decompose in these states, so that we can use that information to determine where they died, how long ago they died, and what state they died.
That's an anthology series.
That's a neat idea, right?
The setting was really cool.
Setting is really, really creepy. It's a good start. And then just off to the side of all of these corpses, there's a brand new one. Some guy just died here or got murdered here. And it could be anyone, because
they pull a tarp off the guy. I think he's got an arrow in him, and he dies in front of all the students.
And now everyone at the school is a suspect, because every single one of them knows a lot about forensic medicine and have access to this thing. And you know what?
That's cute.
That's a good setup. That's a good opening for a murder. And the way that that episode plays out gets a little predictable after a while. But that's actually, of the done in one episodes, that's probably the best one.
Yeah,
it's pretty clever. It's got a good setup.
It's an interesting setting. Like, they end up going on this thing about this young kid, and there's a random poisoner running around. Yeah.
Kid thinks his mom might have died under mysterious circumstances, and there turns out that the guy who's running the school might have some skeletons in his closet, and he's been like cremating people like before they're done checking them for various bits of evidence and. It's a good location. Yeah. It's a good locale. It works mostly.
The next episode is called Game On. What was the story of this one?
The bone collector is back, and he's got three.
There's a bone collector.
The bone collector does a thing where he works in threes. He'll have three victims like throughout New York, and when you find one, there's a clue to the two others.
This is the fifth episode. And that's a good place to bring the main character back.
Yeah, this is a 10-episode season, so yeah, at this point, you either need to bring in the Bone Collector or admit you're not going to have a whole season-long arc.
It always upsets me when they have the, sort of like the Big Bad, and then they bring back Big Bad in number 3. That's too soon.
A little quick.
But bring back in number 7.
You want to keep the tease going.
Yeah, you bring him back in the penultimate episode, that's good, because that's the climax, or right in the middle. Those are the only places. And, we got to learn a little bit more about how the bone collector operates in this version of the story, and how he collects bones, and we get a lot of facts about it. We also get to learn a little bit more about Lincoln Rhyme. He's also epileptic.
Lincoln Rhyme is an epileptic. He has like a seizure condition brought on from his overall condition.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And this will be important later.
He has like seizures though.
And if he doesn't receive care, he could die. The next episode is called "Till Death Do Us Part,"
and this had a clever killer twist.
This also was a pretty cool setup.
Because first of all, let me pause and address Lincoln Rhyme's computers, because they're the most absurd things I've seen.
God.
The movie. Lincoln Rhyme had like a big sort of curved wide screen, and
pretty futuristic for the 90s.
And the Angelina Jolie character had like a little camera around her. I think it was around her neck, or maybe she wore it on her head.
I forget. Yeah.
But she had a camera that he was always looking through. Yeah. So, and they contacted through an earpiece.
Yeah.
And he was in bed watching the crime happen on this big curved screen.
Yeah.
Nothing so high tech or elaborate in this. In this one, they literally attached sheets of glass to what looked like just PVC pipe. You'd find it in a dumpster behind an Anawalt.
Yeah.
And they tried to make it high tech by like raising it and lowering it, but you can like see the strings and like the stage hand kind of lowering it.
They're clearly projecting.
They composite in the image on these like three screens, but it's the cheapest looking thing.
It
doesn't look like a computer at all.
It must have been incredibly boring to film. What's her name? Hold on. I'm trying to make sure I remember the name of this one actor I interviewed. I was doing a Comic-Con red carpet for the show Arrow. And I got to interview Emily Bette Ricards, who plays Felicity Smoke on that show. She did. The show's over now. And she was the tech person. And almost all of her dialogue is while she's like tippity-tapping on a typeboard, on a keyboard. And I always ask her, like, what are you typing?
Uh-huh.
Like, what do you do? Are you just, like, doing, like, oh, you know, every good boy does fine, or, like, whatever, you know, small brown, the quick
brown frocks jumps over the lazy dog.
Yeah, you know, what are you typing? And she's just like, I'm not typing anything because if I actually hit the keyboard, it would ruin the sound. So every time I'm typing, I'm hovering my fingers above the keys and they had all that shit in post. And I'm like, it must be so weird and hard and probably boring after a while to do these kinds of scenes. Yeah. Anytime you're doing all this computer work in a TV show, it's like, my God, and so many people whose their whole character is just in front of a keyboard the whole time.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Or like, we always see their faces, like the tech people, and they're leaning forward in screens and like hitting a key and saying cliche things like, gotcha. There's probably, it's light to light their face so we can see what it is. There's probably nothing on that screen.
Probably not.
So that's some good acting.
I also interviewed Elizabeth Moss for when she played Shirley Jackson in that which I liked more than you, but it's a great performance regardless.
Right. She's great. But
You know, she in that movie she's writing a book. I think she's writing the book Hangs a Man, and so she's typing on a typewriter the whole time, and she also did a lot of typing on Mad Men. And I asked her, like, "Are you a good typist by now?" And she's like, "I never learned how to type."
Wow.
Never came up. I thought that was the funniest thing.
Talking just the tech goes to this episode because the tech is clearly designed for people who don't understand computers very well.
Yeah.
This is a show for your grandparents or your aunts. Yeah.
The idea is
it's so easy to consume. It's so unchallenging, and it presents technology and a lot of dated ideas about police work and serial killers. It's clearly deliberately not up to date. Yeah. It's also clearly trying to appeal to maybe an older audience.
Well, it's also very demonizing about any time some new technology comes around. Anytime a new technology comes around, the first thing I guarantee you, someone who writes for these kind of shows, is how can I turn that into the perfect murder?
Yeah.
And as a result, oftentimes the first appearance or the first introduction a lot of people have to some of these new ideas or these new technologies is being demonized in the show. Like there's a technology called CRISPR, which is gene splicing technology, and it's actually incredibly promising for like cancer treatments, and it's like could really realistically be some of the most exciting and positive technological advancements in medicine in our lives.
But we turned it into a horror movie a couple times
immediately
already.
The first thing was like I started watching like horror shows or like movie Splice or that's how like Luke Cage got his powers, as he was like a mad scientist used CRISPR on him. Oh no,
really?
CRISPR is the something like that.
Oh god.
And I'm like, you know what, that's not fucking helping. So in this one, the idea is one of Lincoln Rhyme's friends is accused of murdering his wife. And the idea is he was having a fight with his wife. Typical shit. I think she was cheating on him. And he went out to his car, realized he forgot his keys. And when he came back, she had already been murdered. Very narrow window for someone to do this. And as a result, everyone thinks he did it. But Lincoln Rhyme just doesn't buy it. He knows the guy too well. And it turns out someone has been stalking people in their homes using their security systems. So they know when they're having like that kind of a fight or whatever, and then as soon as an opportunity presents itself, they just swoop in, kill someone, and then leave.
Which, I like that. I like it's that as an MO for a killer.
Yeah, but it's like very demonizing of home security technology, of your Amazon Echo, all that kind of shit. Not that all those things are good. Not that aren't incredibly invasive and dangerous, but it's also just basically how can we make them seem more so as much as possible.
Also, when the word hacker leaked into the popular consciousness sometime in the early 90s, all of a sudden, hackers were like sort of the ghost villains of every tech story.
Exactly.
They just can get in. Like, hackers can break into your Roomba. And I would love to see a heist movie where they like the heisters hack into a Roomba, and because the Roomba's constantly going around the floor, they actually are able to track its movements and get a floor plan of an apartment that way.
That's actually not bad.
Yeah, I'd love to see that plot point in a movie at some point. Because that would like finally bring to attention how ridiculous this urban legend is that hackers can get into your Roomba.
Oh my god.
So yeah, that hackers can just sort of get into your home security technology and But I like that.
Like, I'm sure they can, but how many enemies do you have is the question. Well, like, will they bother trying?
How much fucking time and energy do you need to put into spying on people constantly, waiting for them to argue just so you can murder somebody?
Like, you have to really want to, you know? Yeah,
What are you doing to make money while you're being a hacker, a hacker serial killer? Like, what's your side job?
Yeah.
What do you have time to do to earn money?
Again, it's a matter of, like, if they really want to, they will. Like, right. I've known people who didn't lock their cars in Los Angeles because the idea is if they want to steal my car, it doesn't matter if it's locked. Mm. They'll just break the window and take the car.
Yeah.
So who gives a shit? Like, I don't, I feel like that's making it a little too easy, but there you go. Speaking of the tech, by the way, in the first episode, when they send Amelia Sachs, Ariel Kebble's character, out in the field to be Lincoln Rimes' eyes in wherever she was going, they introduce her to the rig she'll be wearing. And the idea is that
she wears this thing around her neck.
She wears like this, it's almost like a vest when they first introduce it. And the idea is that it'll give Lincoln Rimes like a 360 degree around her.
Yeah.
So he can get a whole sense of the, even if she's not looking at something, he can see it.
And Lincoln Rhyme is paralyzed. He can move his head left to right.
Yeah.
And he has a little bit of mobility in one of his hands.
Yes, which he can use to control computer screens and also play video games with his son, who is like moved away because the bone collector is still at large and it could be in danger. In the first episode, we're introduced to that rig and it's like all in like this big vest or whatever like that. Second episode, they just flat out say, yeah, we made it a lot smaller, and now it's like a lapel pin.
Like, we can't see it now.
Yeah, because...
I wish
because
she had worn the rig. I understand it's probably uncomfortable for the actor.
I'm sure the actor hated it. I'm sure the costume designers hated it. Mm. I'm sure it was a pain in the ass in the production. It's so much easier this way, but it's also so much more interesting to the show if there's actually something cumbersome about it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like there's actually like some downside to it.
Like she has this like physical reminder of this boss. Essentially, her boss is always looking at her.
Yeah.
There's if you've ever worked in a like retail or worked in any place that has a security camera on you, you get a little paranoid. Is the boss watching me at this moment?
Yeah.
That would be an interesting sort of workplace dynamic where Lincoln Rhyme is essentially always breathing down her neck.
Yeah.
I do appreciate that they made the earpiece visible and she touches it a lot.
Yeah.
I appreciate that kind of clarity. We've gotten so used to the notion of the earpiece in action movies that people are in desperate scenes of like some action sequence and they're just yelling out into the ether and other characters can just sort of hear them.
I think it's Casino Royale
They hardly ever mention at all that they geared up beforehand, that they all have earpieces. When did they get these earpieces?
I think the remake of Casino Royale gave everyone permission to stop doing that because there's a whole bit in Casino Royale when they're keeping an eye on a bomb maker and it's James Bond and some other guy you'll never see again. And they're talking over the thing. It's like, yes, he's over there. And James Bond looks at the guy and the guy's touching his ear whenever he talks. Says, stop touching. You don't need to touch your ear. You don't need to do that. It's like speaking louder when you're on the phone. You don't need to. It's completely unnecessary. You do it because you're in a movie and people at home need to understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
So here they're doing that again. They really don't need to, but it's clarity. You're right. It's TV.
I appreciate that kind of clarity. We're making it easy to
consume. Yeah. These things don't bother me.
Yeah.
I might nitpick once in a while, but I don't actually give a shit.
I don't, it doesn't ruin a film. It's just, I appreciate when they're paying attention to that kind of detail.
Yeah.
Because especially if it's a procedural show and we need to, you know where, what the characters do, what their expertise is, where they are in a given scene, how they're communicating with one another is kind of important.
Agreed.
And if they put a little bit of thought and energy into the way Lincoln Rhyme is looking into the crime scene, as he needs to in every episode, it would be nice if there was something visual to that.
Yeah. The next episode is called Requiem. This one is about...
This is a
Mad Bomber episode. Someone's been blowing up various locales run by an allegedly corrupt real estate mogul. He turns out he is corrupt, and the bomber nearly blows a bunch of people up. But Amelia manages to stop it. And then the episode is over.
Well, this is the one that ends with the twist you mentioned earlier, where the bone collector's wife finds all the pictures, and that's how the episode ends.
That's the most interesting part of the episode. Yeah. The actual episode itself is kind of disposable.
The penultimate episode, directed by John Amiel.
Are we skipping the kidnapping episode?
No, we're up to the last two episodes.
There's three episodes, because we haven't talked about Original Sin, where the congressman's daughter gets kidnapped.
Oh, you're right. We did it.
Real fast. There's an episode where a congressman's daughter gets kidnapped. They find her.
And yeah, and
it's kind of it's not very interesting. It's really fine.
Like they send the severed finger. Is the politician corrupt because he's running for office now? Is he using his daughter as for political gain? And we realize in private conversations, no, he actually doesn't care if he wins so long as he gets his daughter back.
Turns out it's someone on the campaign was funneling money in to like pay her sleazebag brother's debt. It's not very interesting.
No, it's the most predictable kind of kidnapping
story. It's basically just there to make it like to make us have to work to get to the final two-parter episode.
But I apologize, John Amiel did that the kidnapping episode.
Oh, he did. Okay.
And John Amiel, who did a really excellent post Silence of the Lambs serial killer movie called Copycat in the mid 90s.
Yeah, Copycat. I will go to bat for that movie any old day. Copycat rules.
He also did a movie in the early 2000s called The Core, which is unbelievably absurd and
very stupid movie.
And weirdly watchable.
It's very watchable. He actually made a couple of movies I really quite like. He did The Man Who Knew Too Little.
Oh, that was
which is a very likable Bill Murray movie.
I don't know why that got such heat when it came out.
It was very light and very disposable. It wasn't like a Groundhog Day super hit or whatever like that. But the gag is that Bill Murray is the annoying brother of, I think, Peter Gallagher, I think.
And Peter Gallagher lives in England.
Yeah, and so what he does is, in order to get Bill Murray out of his hair so that he won't, like, embarrass him in front of his, like, business buddies, he signs him up for one of those, like, living theater things where, like, you get to be a spy in this fake espionage thing.
The actors sort of feed you lines as you go. You get to improvise a little bit of it, and it's filmed out on the street, so you get to go on this, like, sort of theatrical scavenger hunt. That was a real thing.
You can still kind of do that, but the gag is that Bill Murray accidentally winds up in an actual super spy story, and he's completely nonchalant about all of it because he thinks it's all fake. And everyone else is completely amazed that this guy is like killing all of these people and he's totally nonplussed. It's a funny movie. It's legitimately very charming. And nobody cared. And it really pissed me off. I thought that was a cute film.
And there's some good dark moments that come up on a guy who's been killed. He's like dead in a chair.
Yeah.
And Bill Murray thinks he's acting.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, this is a live actor. Wow. He's like really committed to the role. Yeah. And he like turns away. He's like, yeah, he doesn't know anything. Catch this. And he throws something at the corpse. Bonks his chest.
Well, then there's this moment where like this his like super spy partner. Is it Joanne Whaley?
It's Joanne Whaley.
Joanne Whaley. She's like upset because people are dying. And he's like, how do you do that? How do you just, like, cry on cue like that?
Do you poke your eye and think about your dog dying?
It's like, maybe I can do it, too. My dog is dead.
No, I can't do it.
I can't do it. You're a much better actor than I am. And he's like, what the fuck is the matter with you?
And he incurs the wrath of, like Alfred Molina plays, like, the Russian hitman is on his tail.
Yeah. And John Amiel, underrated filmmaker. Yeah. He ended up moving mostly to television, and I guess he's doing well. Good for him. But
did an episode of a new show on NBC. Go guy.
But yeah, the final couple episodes is, for a while, they've been trying to go back to square one with the Bone Collector, and instead of trying to catch him now, try to catch him in the past and try to figure out, because he's like super smart and isn't making mistakes, so they figure he must have made a mistake at some point, so we're going to try to figure out if he tried to be a serial killer and failed earlier on.
Yeah, the idea was he's not just a serial killer, he also kidnaps his victims first, because he has to sort of, like, torture them and remove bones and stuff, so he does have to remove them from public life.
Yeah.
And so they decide, instead of investigating him as a murderer and find out what his M.O. is as a killer, they say, well, how does he kidnap people?
Yeah.
You would think they would have looked into that.
Doesn't that seem like a...
That's like a pretty obvious thing to look... This is another case of the smart people thinking of the dumb thing.
It's not like Silence of the Lambs, where like the whole idea of Silence of the Lambs is Jane Gumm, the killer in Silence of the Lambs, didn't always like his bodies were discovered in kind of a random order. But because of that, people weren't actually putting his crimes into the proper context, and his actual first murder was actually considered like his third.
Yeah.
And that's what makes Clarice Starling go back to, like, what was considered the third crime scene and treat it like it was the start of the crime wave, and that's what led to the apprehension of Jane Gumm. It's still something that they probably would have thought of, but it's a little clever, and it's something that might have slipped under the cracks.
It's not something that you, as a viewer, would have necessarily thought of.
Exactly.
And
whereas
when this really obvious sort of twist is presented, all they want from the audience is, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
You thought of that ahead of me, show.
That's all I ask.
You made me think that I was clever for a minute. Or you seemed like you did something clever for a minute. And that's as complex a twist as you need in a show like The Bone Collector.
But the problem with The Bone Collector is it introduces a really simple concept, which is, hey, maybe we should see if he committed other crimes. And you're just sort of like, yeah, you've been looking for this guy for how many years and it never occurred to you to see if he, like, also, like, committed earlier crimes? Feels like sort of thing you would come up with before, like, 9 years have passed, or whatever the fuck it is. Like, it's been a while. So, anyway, they finally find someone who he had kidnapped but hadn't killed, who was able to identify him, and they do. And his name is out there in the open, and now he's basically a fugitive.
And then the last episode of the series, he has nothing left to lose, so he just goes on a cop-killing spree.
Yeah, he attacks everybody. He almost kills Michael Imperioli.
Minor characters that we don't really care about die.
He puts a bomb in the restaurant where Amelia's parents were murdered, so that it would distract her. Meanwhile, where everyone's there trying to, like, stop that crime from happening, he's in Lincoln Rhyme's house.
Yeah.
And that's where the whole thing where Lincoln Rhyme has seizures comes into play, because he fakes one, because this guy doesn't want Lincoln Rhyme to die. He wants to, like, Lincoln Rhyme to be amazed by his genius.
Showed up, yeah.
So that's the thing. He's like, well, you've got to save him.
And
that's the result. He doesn't kill Lincoln Rhyme's assistant, and it's a whole thing.
But it's
not bad. It's a pretty good way around that.
Lincoln Rhyme does say aloud, however, what the audience is saying aloud, really, this is just about jealousy.
Yeah.
Like, professional jealousy seems like such a paltry motivation to become a serial killer.
Well, they also throw it back in his face, which is like, no, this isn't about Lincoln Rhyme. You were doing this shit before you ever met him.
Yeah.
This is who you are. This is a compulsion. This is a psychological affliction that goes much deeper than that. That's just the excuse you're telling yourself.
Yeah.
And you've created a fixation on Lincoln Rhyme because it justifies what you're doing.
There's another vaguely clever twist with the camera in this episode where at the very beginning of the series, we got to see Lincoln Rhyme defuse a bomb, and he defused the bomb, but the catwalk he was sitting on with the victim gave out under him,
it was booby-trapped.
And that's what broke his back and left him bedridden. And in this final episode, they bring that same bomb back. I think it's even the same prop. And, am I going to pull the wire now? Or maybe he thinks I'm going to pull this wire, and I think you're going to pull the other one.
Yeah.
And, they figure out that the Bone Collector is in Lincoln Rhyme's apartment, so she puts the camera right next to the bomb and then, like, breaks the camera and makes it seem like the bomb went off, so it looks like, from Lincoln Rhyme's perspective, that everything bombed. I thought the show was going to be that ballsy and kill all of the cast.
That would have been amazing. What a great ending that would have been. That would have been exciting. Not what happened.
No, it's everyone's not that edgy a show.
Lincoln Rhymes' like family is in town, and so they're spirited away. A cop whose like presence on the show was so negligible, I kept forgetting he was a recurring character. Dies, and there's a whole bit where he's dying, and his last words were "watch," and they're like, "watch what?" And never occurred to them until like later that day that he meant wristwatch.
Yeah.
And he had a smartwatch that he had like put on Lincoln Rhymes' son that would actually have like a GPS tracker on it, so they're able to just find him. And I actually really like at the end when like Lincoln Rhyme
just clever enough.
Yeah, and then he insists that Lincoln Rhyme come see him alone, and Lincoln Rhyme does, and he's just like, yeah, you know, we had a GPS, we actually didn't need to solve any of your stupid ass clues this time, which I actually appreciate when you can just skip over a bit.
Yeah.
Wait, we found a cheat code.
Okay, I'll go to jail. I'm fine. Just take me to jail. But, like, go to the dam and look at the one I left there, because I was really proud of that.
That was a clever clue, man. Come on.
Like, I had to find, like, this really rare kind of deer that is only found, like, overseas, and that you're going to have to figure out how, like, the code word that I had put behind this one. Oh, can you just go?
There was an episode of Brooklyn Nine-Nine where Jake Peralta was having his bachelor party, and his best friend had created, like, a scavenger hunt, but he didn't want a scavenger hunt. He just wanted to get drunk with his buddies and have a good time. So the one guy like faked his own kidnapping for the scavenger hunt. It's like, you'll have to solve all the clues. I'll see you at midnight. Ah! And so everyone else just goes out drinking, and because they have the GPS, they know where his phone is. So they just go there at midnight, and the dude's like, gentlemen, you've solved all of my clues. Present your gold coins. We didn't have those.
Yeah.
You didn't do the scavenger hunt? No. then you didn't meet famed character actor Reginald Vell Johnson, like from Die Hard, your favorite movie. Like, I enlisted him to do this, and he was waiting for you at like 9 o'clock after you saw the clues, and he's like, "No, he skipped all the cool stuff."
Well, I admit I'm the kind of nerd that did that. Aww. I wrote my own scavenger hunts for some of my birthday parties.
Well, that's fun.
I planted clues all over town, and I was like literally taping clues to the back of tombstones and stuff. I got the cemetery's permission.
That's last time I did one of those, I won something based on a cheat. And it was supposed to be, they were like, you have to find a really tiny house. And the idea was that if you're walking along this road, there's one house that's like surprisingly smaller than all the others.
Okay.
But what we were just like running late. And so like I went to like a pharmacy or something. Mm-hmm. And I picked up an episode of Entertainment Weekly back when House was on the air. And I just found the tiniest picture I could find of House. <That's> they had to give it to me. It was a very tiny house.
That was clever. But yeah, I thought ahead though. I knew people couldn't just, because the party was going to be back at my house.
Yeah, of course.
So I didn't want people to just run around town and say, "Yeah, I did it," and I win. So on every clue I taped around town, there was a password. You had to write it down.
You're smart.
Make sure everybody does it. Yeah. Only two teams finished. One went through every clue very dutifully and showed up on time. They won. And then after everybody else had already given up and come to the party, the last team came in and said, "We figured it out." So they came in second.
Oh, yeah.
I gave them second prize.
That's nice.
And I had some pretty nice prizes.
I hope you did. Anyway, and then in the last episode, Lincoln Rhyme confronts the bone collector, and he actually has something like taped to his shirt, like a needle with a paralytic on it, that he like grabs with his teeth and like stabs the guy with it when he gets too close, and now he's paralyzed, and the irony. And then they capture the bone collector, and that's when, after they like have like a funeral for the one cop who died, there's one plot point that they never resolved because they skipped over some bits. And this I thought was clever. They said like, okay, yeah, so like there's one of the bone collector's clues was the tracking number on a package that'll arrive like later tonight. Mm. And they're like, well, but they found him without needing to solve that clue. The package arrives anyway.
Yeah.
And
it's got bones in them.
Yeah. They get a phone call from a guy who says, "You got my package?" Mm. And like, yeah, go outside. So they go outside, and then someone falls off a building, and you're just like, "Oh shit!" That package was from another serial killer.
And I didn't know who that was who fell off the building.
Was
it just some random person? Or
if it was someone from the show, I missed it. If it was, it would have been cool if it was someone from the show. I don't think they did a good job of selling it. But regardless, there's another serial killer out there, and now honestly, for the first time,
you're a little intrigued.
My head's actually kind of swimming with the possibilities. Is he part of like some sort of fraternal order of serial killers, and they were all working together?
Oh god!
Now I'm actually kind of interested because clearly he was in cahoots with somebody. Mm. He had an apprentice or a partner or a pen pal or something, and like now I'm kind of or copycat. But regardless, now it seems like the world has more possibilities. And now, of course, the show is fucking canceled. And I kind of wish you'd done that earlier so that maybe people would have been more intrigued and watched the show more rather than spend a lot of time padding this out with filler episodes. Because, let's be honest here, one or two decent ones aside, those were filler episodes, and we really didn't need them.
This is not an interesting show with filler episodes. It's like I said, it's a filler show.
Yeah.
This is meant to be a non-threatening all throughout. I think it wasn't.
But the problem is most interesting stuff is the non-filler stuff.
Yeah. As a filler show goes, this is totally functional.
It works okay.
And even though I would never, I wouldn't want to go back to this show. I think it's terribly dull. Mm-hmm. I think they don't do anything terribly interesting with the premise. Mm-hmm. I think it's smart in a stupid way.
Mm-hmm. I think Hornsby grounds it really, really well. I think he's a very good actor. Yeah. But other than that, it's not
the rest
really
of the cast is a little bit forgettable.
Sort of fine,
they're not playing very interesting characters. Yeah. They're not playing those non-interesting characters.
Imperioli is just
wasted.
Yeah, he's such a good actor, and he really, there's like nothing to the character he plays that like is
so.
It's a shame.
But I would never watch this show. But I'm going to say that it was canceled too soon because this is the kind of show like NCIS, like CSI, like Law and Order that could chug away as a gentle distraction for upwards of 15 years maybe win an Emmy or two, and then just fade away, having provided these actors with a lot of good work. And I think maybe in a weird way it deserves that. It, because we always need one of those. We need a couple of those.
Yeah, I don't think this is it, though.
You don't think this is the one?
No, I don't think so. Listen, I like bits of this show. I think there's a couple of good episodes in there, but you could have gotten them from any cop show. Like, the filler episodes, they could have been filler episodes in any cop show. I think Russell Hornsby is really solid. I think I'm a fan of him as an actor. It's a tricky role in many regards, and I think he handles it quite well. The rest of the cast is either underwritten or wasted. And I think the most interesting parts of the show are the parts of it that clearly the network wasn't interested in. This is a filler show. This is a show that fills time. The most interesting parts of it are the parts that don't.
Its ambition was to just be a filler show.
And I think the most interesting parts are the part. I think this doesn't really feel to me like a premise that's a filler show. This feels more like a movie of the week kind of thing. Okay. If this was like Columbo, and there was like every like couple of months we had a 2-hour episode of this that was like one really solid Lincoln Rhyme mystery, and then maybe over the course of like 6 of them we eventually cut up to the Bone Collector, that might work. But I don't think this format works for this. I think this is need to be either a series of movies or a much shorter series of episodes, like 6 per season. Like a Netflix kind of thing or whatever. I think that would have worked stronger. But I don't think this is the right way to do this material.
I think you could have these sort of non-threatening stories if there were more violence. If it was pulpy, lurid, if it was a lot scarier in some way, if the tone were a lot more like a horror movie, like those spy
thrillers
from the
90s, then
it wouldn't really matter as much that the stories are uncreative, because at least we're engaged on a fear level.
I agree with that, and I think if the tone of this thing had been, again, Hannibal is the ultimate extreme of this, but if Hannibal is a 10...
And Hannibal was a network show, wasn't it?
It was, but it was considered very daring for a network show. But it was, because it's extremely violent. But if Hannibal is at a 10 in terms of its sort of like grand guignol extremity, if this was at like a 7.5...
Yeah, that would be fine.
I think that would be a good sweet spot for it. It just needs to be a little bit more malevolent, a little bit more scary. The villains need to be less criminal of the week and more the like super villain of the week.
The monsters who are lurking underneath the city.
These are not just typical criminals. These are monsters, and they need to be, regardless of whether we're sympathetic with how they came to be, which sometimes we are and sometimes we're not, they need to be stopped. And that's something that this show doesn't really have, because ultimately the majority of it feels like same shit, different day.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work.
And that the cops are so I understand they're professionals, and they have to be professional, because especially if they're seeing this week after week, they can't have them breaking down every episode. But maybe you needed somebody to be like a little bit more like the way an audience member would react to these extreme situations.
You had someone who's new to this, a beat cop who's just sort of walking into this, and pretty quickly she gets relatively used to it, and that doesn't really fly. I once co-wrote a slasher comedy with somebody, and there was a gag we had in it where there would be like the body would be discovered and be some horrible gruesome thing, and the cops would be like in the movie 7, like, have you ever seen anything like this? And the veteran cop would be like, no. And then the next time it happened, I'd be like, oh my god, have you ever seen anything like this?
Yeah, no. Once a week, man.
And then, no. And then the next, it was always like something so horrible no one had ever seen it before.
Yeah.
And then finally someone would just die from just being stabbed. And I'm like, have you ever seen anything like this? Yeah, this is the huge. Yeah. It's just like, because it's just every once in a while, it's just like, this is how people die. Stab them, they die. Like, it's bad, but it's not really blowing my mind.
I do appreciate scenes in like, this so rarely happens. I've seen a cop movie where like someone will get stabbed right through the forearm, and then it really hurts. It's awful.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you'll like they'll knock out the killer, but they'll still have the knife in their arm, and there's like the paramedics are there. It's like, hey, what do you know? No, it's okay. I've done this before. Hang on. Oh god, this sucks. Okay, just be there with the paper towels. All right. Like, they know how this goes. Yeah. Like, it hurts, but they know
how
this feels.
It's like someone who can dislocate their shoulder easily. They know how to pop it back. It sucks, but they can do it. Yeah.
Like, Tony Hawk has said he knows what a concussion feels like. Oh, like, he's fallen over so many times.
Oh, that's not good.
He's a skateboarder. It happens a lot. So, he's like, oh, yeah, that's a concussion.
Yeah.
This one's not a concussion.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that is Lincoln Rhyme, The Hunt for the Bone Collector. Whitney says, cancel too soon. I say not so much.
That's not an endorsement of the show, by the way.
It's not even
a show I really like, but yeah. I feel like this is the kind of inoffensive police procedural that you could catch, like, when you checked into a motel and it's just on cable.
I think it's funny that Whitney is, in some respects, actually kind of almost harsher on the show than I am, but he's saying it was canceled too soon. Yeah. And I'm saying it wasn't canceled too soon, but that doesn't mean it's awful.
Yeah.
it's somewhere in the middle. Mm. But in any case...
I'll say that's... And I don't say this often. There's a virtue to mediocrity. That there's a place for this kind of show.
There is. We need something that's just easily. We need chewing gum.
Yeah.
You know, it's something. It needs to be available, doesn't it?
This is the pack of extra pink flavor that you just grab.
It's
on
bubble
the
yum.
Yeah.
It's bubble yum. There it's you. Bubble yum. Next time on Cancel Too Soon, we'll be back with a sci-fi series about an alien spacecraft that is flying through our solar system and just tossing chunks of high-tech debris at the planet that lands and becomes a whole thing.
The technology is having a mysterious effect on things on Earth.
And it's called debris, which is, that tracks. But we'll talk about this sci-fi series, which is canceled after only one season, on the next episode of Canceled Too Soon.
Incidentally, also an NBC series.
Oh, coincidence. We don't really think about that.
If you want to watch along, it's on Peacock.
Okay. It's also on, I think it's also on Hulu.
Okay.
I was able to watch it on, I think, Hulu. But it's available. Thank you everybody for listening to Canceled Too Soon. Hope you're enjoying the show. If you want to... hear more of us. Of course, we have more shows here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where we have a lot of exclusive programming, including shows we're reviewing every single episode of Star Trek, every single episode of the 1960s Batman, every film ever nominated for Best Picture. We do commentary tracks, online hangouts, the whole galore. And a very, very special shout out to all of our patrons, without whom we wouldn't be able to bring you this show or any of the others. So thank you very much for everyone who's able to pitch in. It means the world to us. Mm. If you want to join in the conversation, you can follow us on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
We also have an email address. It's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And if you email us and want to talk about the show or anything we discussed on this episode or anything at all, really, ask us questions. We have a podcast called We've Got Mail where we answer your emails. And also we have a P.O. box for those who prefer to send physical letters.
Mm-hmm.
Whitney?
Right into our P.O. Box. Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Whitney, am I forgetting anything?
I also have another podcast.
You do? Tell them about it.
It's going to be moving to a monthly podcast starting in October, but right now you can hear me and B. Peterson talk about everything that is on Ovid that we managed to see this week. It's called All About Ovid, spelled with three O's, All About Ovid. And Ovid is a streaming service that offers a lot of deep cut art house stuff and stuff that played in museums, stuff for which the Criterion Collection is just too awful, man.
The Criterion Collection
sold
is
out
mainstream.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
B put it this way: I've seen bad films on the Criterion Channel. We haven't seen any bad film. There haven't been any like real duds on Ovid that we've encountered yet.
Yet. And when you find it, you need to tell me because I'm very
absolutely
curious.
I will. Last episode, B and I discuss Happy Hour, which they caught up on. I had seen it last week, which is a Japanese film about the friendship between four women. We were attracted to it because it's 5 hours and 17 minutes in length. anything super long, we're going to get under. And I also watched a terrifically long film called Hotel Terminus, the documentary film by Marcel Ofels, about the aftermath of World War II for Klaus Barbie, one of the most notorious Nazi torturers, and how he was abetted by various world governments and lived to be a very old age, and died in prison in 1991.
That's not good.
Yeah,
okay.
wasn't put on trial until, like, was caught in 1984, put on trial. Went on for a while, put in prison for life.
Jesus Christ.
Died in prison in 1991, and it's about sort of the outrage of that system, so you get to hear B and I talk about Hotel Terminus and Happy Hour on the latest episode of All About Ovid.
Yeah, and also, me and my partner, M. Lopez da Silva, we have a soap store over on Etsy. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at SaltCatSoap, all one word. We also have links to... Oh, we're also on Facebook. And we have links to our store on Etsy from there. We have a lot of handcrafted soaps. They smell lovely, a lot of different varieties. We're coming up with some Halloween designs right now. Those should be available first week of October. But until then, if you want some soap now, every purchase, you get a 10% off coupon for a future purchase. So you can use that for Halloween, during the holidays, to make great gifts. Check us out. Mm. So, again, thank you everybody for listening. We'll see you next time on Cancel Too Soon. And until then, that is a wrap. And we'll also see you next season.